Ego and not competence drives what we undertake. We have blind spots. If you know what you understand, you know where you have an edge over others. When you are honest about where your knowledge is lacking, you know where you are vulnerable and where you can improve. Understanding your circle of competence improves decision-making and outcomes. In order to get the most out of this mental model, we will explore the following. 1. What is a circle of competence? 2. How do you know when you have one? 3. How do you build and maintain one? 4. How do you operate outside of one? What is a circle of competence? Imagine an old man who spent his entire life up in a small town. He's the lifer. No detail of the goings-on in the town has escaped his notice over the years. He knows the lineage, behavior, attitudes, jobs, income, and social status of every person in town. Bit by bit, he built that knowledge up over a long period of observation and participation in town affairs. The lifer knows where the bodies are buried and who buried them. He knows who owes money to whom, who gets along with whom, and whom the town depends on to keep spinning. He knows about that time the mayor cheated on his taxes. He knows about that time the town flooded, how many inches high the water was, and exactly who helped whom and who didn't. Now imagine a stranger enters the town in from the big city. Within a few days, the stranger decides that he knows all there is to know about the town. He's met the mayor, the sheriff, the bartender, and the shopkeeper, and he can get around fairly easily. It's a small town, and he hasn't come across anything surprising. In the stranger's mind, he's convinced he pretty much knows everything a lifer would know. He has sized up the town in no time with his keen eye. He makes assumptions based on what he has learned so far and figures he knows enough to get his business done. This, however, is a false sense of confidence that likely causes him to take more risks than he realizes. Without intimately knowing the history of the town, how can he be sure that he has picked the right land for development or negotiated the best price? After all, what kind of knowledge does he really have compared to the lifer? The difference between the detailed web of knowledge in the lifer's head and the surface knowledge in the stranger's head is the difference between being inside a circle of competence and being outside the perimeter. True knowledge of a complex territory cannot be faked. The lifer could stump the stranger in no time, but not the other way around. Consequently, as long as the lifer is operating in his circle of competence, he will always have a better understanding of reality to use in making decisions. Having this deep knowledge gives him flexibility in responding to challenges, because he will likely have more than one solution to every problem. And this depth increases his efficiency. He can eliminate bad choices quickly because he has all of the pieces of the puzzle. What happens when you take the lifer-stranger idea seriously and try to delineate carefully the domains in which you're on one or the other? There is no definite checklist for figuring this out, but if you don't have at least a few years and a few failures under your belt, you cannot consider yourself competent in a circle. We shall be unable to turn natural advantage to account unless we make use of local guides. Sun Tzu. For most of us, climbing the summit of Mount Everest is outside of our circle of competence. Not only do we have no real idea of how to do it, but even more scary, should we attempt it, we don't even know what we don't know. If we studied hard, maybe we'd figure out the basics. We'd learn about the training, the gear, the process, and the time of year, all things an outsider could quickly know. But at what point would you be satisfied that you knew enough to get up there and back with your life intact? And how confident would you be in this assessment? There are approximately 200 bodies on Everest, not to mention the ones that have been removed. All of those people thought they could get up and down alive. The climate preserves their corpses, almost as a warning. The ascent to the summit takes you by the bodies of people who once shared your dreams. Since the first recorded attempts to climb Everest in 1922, all climbers have relied on the specialized knowledge of the Sherpa people to help them navigate the terrain of the mountain. Indigenous to the region, Sherpas grew up in the shadows of the mountain, uniquely placed to develop the circle of competence necessary to get to the top. Sherpa Tenzing Norgay led the team that made the first ascent, and a quarter of all subsequent ascents have been made by Sherpas, with some going as many as 16 or more times. Although the mountain is equally risky for everyone, most people who climb Everest do it once. For the Sherpas, working and climbing various parts of the mountain is their day job. Would you try to climb Everest without their help? The physical challenges alone of reaching the summit are staggering. It is a region that humans aren't suited for. There isn't enough oxygen in the air, and the top is regularly pummeled by winds of more than 150 miles an hour, stronger than a Category 5 hurricane. You don't get to the top on a whim, and you don't survive with only luck. Norgay worked for years as a trekking porter and was part of a team that tried to ascend Everest in 1935. He finally succeeded in reaching the summit in 1953, after 20 years of climbing and trekking in the region. He developed his expertise through lots of lucky failures. After Everest, Norgay opened a mountaineering school to train other locals as guides and a trekking company to take other climbers into the Himalayas. Norgay is around the closest to someone could come to being a lifer when it comes to the competence required to climb Mount Everest. How do you know you have a circle of competence? Within our circles of competence, we know exactly what we don't know. We are able to make decisions quickly and relatively accurately. We possess detailed knowledge of additional information we might need to make a decision with full understanding, or even what information is unobtainable. We know what is knowable and what is unknowable and can distinguish between the two. We can anticipate and respond to objections because we've heard them before and already put in the work of gaining the knowledge to counter them. We also have a lot of options when we confront problems in our circles. Our deep fluency in subjects we are dealing with means we can draw on different information resources and understand what can be adjusted and what is invariant. A circle of competence cannot be built quickly. We don't become lifers overnight. It isn't the result of taking a few courses or working at something for a few months. Being a lifer requires more than skimming the surface. In Alexander Pope's poem, An Essay on Criticism, he writes, "A little learning is a dangerous thing. Drink deep or taste not the Parian spring. There shallow droughts intoxicate the brain, and drinking largely sobers us again." There's no shortcut to understanding. Building a circle of competence takes years of expertise, of making mistakes, and actively seeking out better methods of practice and thought. How do you build and maintain a circle of competence? One of the essential requirements of a circle of competence is that you can never take it for granted. You can't operate as if a circle of competence is a static thing that once attained is attained for life. The world is dynamic, knowledge gets updated, and so too must your circle. There are three key practices needed in order to build and maintain a circle of competence: curiosity and a desire to learn, monitoring, and feedback. First, you have to be willing to learn. Learning comes when experience meets reflection. You can learn from your own experiences, or you can learn from the experience of others through books, articles, and conversations. Learning everything on your own is costly and slow. You are one person. Learning from the experiences of others is much more productive. You need to always approach your circle with curiosity, seeking out information that can help you expand and strengthen it. Learn from the mistakes of others. You can't live long enough to make them all yourself. Anonymous. Second, you need to monitor your track record in areas which you have or want to have a circle of competence. And you need to have the courage to monitor honestly so the feedback can be used to your advantage. The reason we have such difficulty with overconfidence is demonstrated in studies which show that most of us are much worse drivers, lovers, managers, traders, and many other things than we think we are is because we have a problem with honest self-reporting. We don't keep the right records because we don't really want to know what we're good and bad at. Ego is a powerful enemy when it comes to better understanding reality. But that won't work if you're trying to assess or build your circle of competence. You need to keep a precise diary of your trades if you're investing in the stock market. If you're in a leadership position, you need to observe and chronicle the results of your decisions and evaluate them based on what you are trying to achieve. You need to be honest about your failures in order to reflect and learn from them. That's what it takes. Keeping a journal of your own performance is the easiest and most private way to give self-feedback. Journals allow you to step outside of your automatic thinking and ask yourself, what went wrong? How could I do better? Monitoring your own performance allows you to see patterns that you simply couldn't see before. This type of analysis is painful for the ego, which is also why it helps build a circle of competence. You can't improve if you don't know what you're doing wrong. Finally, you must occasionally solicit external feedback. This helps build a circle of competence, but is also critical for maintaining one. A lot of professionals have an ego problem. Their view of themselves does not line up with the way other people see them. Before people can change, they need to know these outside views. We need to go to the people we trust, who can give us honest feedback about our traits. These people are in a position to observe us operating within our circles and are thus able to offer relevant perspectives on our competence. Another option is to hire a coach. Atul Gawande is one of the top surgeons in the United States, and when he wanted to get better at being a surgeon, he hired a coach. This is terribly difficult for anyone, let alone a doctor. At first, he felt embarrassed. It had been over a decade since he was evaluated by another person in medical school. Why, he asked, should I expose myself to the scrutiny and fault-finding? The coach worked. Gawande got two things out of this. First, he received something he couldn't see himself and something no one else would point out, if they noticed it at all, knowledge of where his skill and technique was suboptimal. The second thing Gawande took away was the ability to provide better feedback to other doctors. It is extremely difficult to maintain a circle of competence without an outside perspective. We usually have too many biases to solely rely on our own observations. It takes courage to solicit external feedback. So if defensiveness starts to manifest, focus on the result you hope to achieve. How do you operate outside of a circle of competence? Part of successfully using circle of competence includes knowing when we are outside them, when we are not well equipped to make decisions. Since we can't be inside a circle of competence in everything, when we find ourselves strangers in a place filled with lifers, what do? We don't always get to stay around our spots. We must develop a repertoire of techniques for managing when we're outside of our sphere, which can happen all the time. There are three parts to successfully operating outside of a circle of competence. First, learn at least the basics of the realm you're operating in while acknowledging that you're a stranger, not a lifer. However, keep in mind that basic information is easy to obtain and often gives an acquirer an unwarranted confidence. Second, talk to someone whose circle of competence in the area is strong. Take the time to do a bit of research to at least define questions you need to ask and what information you need to make a good decision. If you ask a person to answer the question for you, they'll be giving you a fish. If you ask them detailed and thoughtful questions, you'll learn how to fish. Furthermore, when you need the advice of others, especially in higher-stakes situations, ask questions to probe the limits of their circles. Then ask yourself how this situation might influence the information they choose to provide you. And finally, use a broad understanding of the basic mental models of the world to augment your limited understanding of the field in which you find yourself a stranger. These will help you identify the foundational concepts that would be most useful. These then serve as a guide to help you navigate the situation you are in. There are inevitably areas where you are going to be a stranger, even in the profession in which you excel. It is impossible for our circles of competence to encompass the entire world. Even if we're careful to know the boundaries and take them seriously, we can't always operate inside our circles. Life is simply not that forgiving. We have to make HR decisions without being experts in human psychology, implement technology without having the faintest idea how to fix it if something goes wrong, or design products with an imperfect understanding of our customers. These decisions may be outside of our circles, but they have to get made. When Queen Elizabeth I of England ascended to the throne, her reign was by no means assured. The tumultuous years under her father, brother, and sister had contributed to a political situation that was precarious at best. England was in a religious crisis that was threatening the stability of the kingdom and was essentially broke. Elizabeth knew that there were aspects of leading the country that were outside of her circle of competence. She had an excellent education and had spent most of her life just trying to survive. Perhaps that is why she was able to identify and admit what she didn't know. In her first speech as queen, Elizabeth announced, "I mean to direct all of my actions by good advice and counsel." After outlining her intent upon becoming queen, she proceeded to build her Privy Council, effectively the Royal Advisory Board. She didn't copy her immediate predecessors, filling her council with yes-men or wealthy incompetents who happened to have the same religious values. She blended the old and the new to develop stability and achieve continuity. She kept the group small so that real discussions could happen. She wanted a variety of opinions that could be challenged and debated. In large measure, due to the advice she received from this council, advice that was the product of open debate that took in the circles of competence of each of the participants, Elizabeth took England from a country of civil unrest and frequent persecution to one that inspired loyalty and creativity in its citizens. She sowed the seeds for the empire that would eventually come to control one quarter of the globe. Conclusion. Critically, we must keep in mind that our circles of competence extend only so far. There are boundaries on the areas in which we develop the ability to make accurate decisions. In any given situation, there are people who have a circle, who have put in the time and effort to really understand the information. It is also important to remember that no one can have a circle of competence that encompasses everything. There's only so much you can know with great depth of understanding. This is why being able to identify your circle and knowing how to move around outside of it is so important. Ignorance more often begets confidence than knowledge. Charles Darwin. Sidebar: The problem of incentives. The problem of incentives can really skew how much you can rely on someone else's circle of competence. This is particularly acute in the financial realm. Until recently, nearly all financial products we might be pushed into had commissions attached to them. In other words, our advisor made more money by giving us one set of advice than another, regardless of its wisdom. Fortunately, the rise of things like index funds of the stock and bond markets has mostly alleviated the issue. In cases like financial advisory, we're not on solid ground until we know, in some detail, the compensation arrangement our advisor is under. The same goes for buying furniture, buying a house, or buying a washing machine at a retail store. What does the knowledgeable advisor stand to gain from our purchase? It goes beyond sales, of course. Whenever we are getting advice, it is from a person whose set of incentives is not the same as ours. It is not being cynical to know that this is the case and then act accordingly. Suppose we want to take our car to a mechanic. Most of us, especially in this day and age, are complete strangers in that land. We subsequently are open to being taken advantage of. There is not only an asymmetry in our general knowledge base about the mechanics of a car, there's usually an asymmetry of knowledge about the actual current problem with the car. We haven't been under the hood, but the mechanic has. We know his incentive in this situation. It's to get us to spend as much as possible while still retaining us as a customer. The only solution, at least until we reach a certain level of trust with our mechanic, is to suck it up and learn a bit of the trade. Fortunately, these days, that's easy with the aid of the internet. And we don't need to learn it ahead of time. We can learn it on an as-needed basis. The way to do it, in this case, would be to defer all decisions on major spending until you've had time to poke around the resources you can find online and at least confirm that the mechanic isn't making a major bluff. Sidebar: Staying in your circle. The idea of a circle of competence in the realm of investments was stated very well by Berkshire Hathaway's Warren Buffett. When asked, he recommended that each individual stick to their area of special competence and be very reluctant to stray. For when we stray too far, we get into areas where we don't even know what we don't know. We may not even know the questions we need to ask. To explain his point, Buffett gives the example of a Russian immigrant woman who ran one of his businesses, the famous Nebraska Furniture Mart. The CEO, Rose Blumpkin, spoke little English and could barely read or write, yet had a head for two things, numbers and home furnishings. She stuck to those areas and built one of the country's great retail establishments. Here it is in Buffett's words. "I couldn't have given her $200 million worth of Berkshire Hathaway stock when I bought the business because she doesn't understand stock. She understands cash. She understands furniture. She understands real estate. She doesn't understand stock, so she doesn't have anything to do with them. If you deal with Miss B in what I would call her circle of competence, she's going to buy 5,000 end tables this afternoon if the price is right. She's going to buy 20 different carpets in odd lots and everything else like that because she understands carpets. She wouldn't buy 100 shares of General Motors if it was 50 cents a share." Her iron focus on the things she knew best was largely responsible for her massive success in spite of the obstacles she faced. Supporting idea: falsifiability. Karl Popper wrote, "A theory is part of empirical science if and only if it conflicts with possible experiences and is therefore, in principle, falsifiable by experience." The idea here is that if you can't prove something wrong, you can't really prove it right either. Thus, in Popper's words, science requires testability. If observation shows that the predicted effect is definitely absent, then the theory is simply refuted. This means a good theory must have an element of risk to it, namely, it has to risk being wrong. It must be able to be proven wrong under stated conditions. In a true science, as opposed to pseudoscience, the following statement can be easily made. If X happens, it would show demonstrably that theory Y is not true. We can then design an experiment, a physical one or sometimes a thought experiment, to figure out if X actually does happen. Falsification is the opposite of verification. You must try to show the theory is incorrect, and if you fail to do so, you actually strengthen it. To understand how this works in practice, think of evolution. As mutations appear, natural selection eliminates what doesn't work, thereby strengthening the fitness of the rest of the population. Consider Popper's discussion of the concept of falsifiability in the context of Freud's psychoanalytic theory, which is broadly about the role of repressed childhood memories influencing our unconscious, in turn affecting our behavior. Popper was careful to say that it is not possible to prove the Freudism was either true or not true, at least in part. We can say that we simply don't know whether it's true because it does not make specific, testable predictions. It may have many kernels of truth in it, but we can't tell. The theory would have to be restated in a way to allow experience to refute it. Another interesting piece of Popper's work was an attack on what he called historicism, the idea that history has fixed laws or trends that inevitably lead to certain outcomes. This is where we use examples from the past to make definite conclusions about what is going to happen in the future. Popper considered this kind of thinking pseudoscience, or worse, a dangerous ideology that tempts wannabe state planners and utopians to control society. He did not consider such historic doctrines falsifiable. There is no way, for example, to test whether there is a law of increasing technological complexity in human society, which many are tempted to claim these days because it is not actually a testable hypothesis. Instead of calling them interpretations, we call them laws, or some similarly connotative word that implies an unchanging and universal state that is not open to debate, giving them an authority that they haven't earned. Too frequently, these postulated laws become immune to falsifying evidence. Any new evidence is interpreted through the lens of the theory. For example, we can certainly find confirmations for the idea that humans have progressed in a specifically defined way toward increasing technological complexity. But is that a law of history? In an inviolable sense? Was it always going to be this way? No matter what the starting conditions or developments along the way, were humans always going to increase our technological prowess? We can't really say. Here we hit on the problem of trying to assert any fundamental laws by which human history must inevitably progress. Trend is not destiny. Even if we can derive and understand certain laws of human biological nature, the trends of history itself are dependent on conditions, and conditions change. Bertrand Russell's classic example of the chicken that gets fed every day is a great illustration of this concept. Daily feedings have been going on for as long as the chicken has observed, and thus it supposes that these feedings are a guaranteed part of its life and will continue in perpetuity. The feedings appear as a law until the day the chicken gets its head chopped off. They are then revealed to be a trend, not a predictor of the future state of affairs. Another way to look at it is how we tend to view the worst events in history. We tend to assume that the worst that has happened is the worst that can happen and then prepare for that. We forget that the worst smashed the previous understanding of what was the worst. Therefore, we need to prepare more for the extremes allowable by physics rather than what has happened until now. Applying the filter of falsifiability helps us sort through which theories are more robust. If they can't ever be proven false because we have no way of testing them, then the best we can do is try to determine their probability of being true. I don't know what's the matter with people. They don't learn by understanding, they learn by some other way, by rote or something. Their knowledge is so fragile. Richard Feynman. First Principles Thinking. First principles thinking is one of the best ways to reverse engineer complicated situations and unleash creative possibility. Sometimes called reasoning from first principles, it's a tool to help clarify complicated problems by separating the underlying ideas or facts from any assumptions based on them. What remain are the essentials. If you know the first principles of something, you can build the rest of your knowledge around them to produce something new. The idea of building knowledge from first principles has a long tradition in philosophy. In the Western canon, it goes back to Plato and Socrates, with significant contributions from Aristotle and Descartes. Essentially, they were looking for the foundational knowledge that would not change, and that we could build everything else on, from our ethical systems to our social structures. First principles thinking doesn't have to be quite so grand. When we do it, we aren't necessarily looking for absolute truths. Millennia of epistemological inquiry have shown us that these are hard to come by, and the scientific method has demonstrated that knowledge can only be built when we are actively trying to falsify it. Rather, first principles thinking identifies the elements that are, in the context of any given situation, non-reducible. First principles do not provide a checklist of things that will always be true. Our knowledge of first principles changes as we understand more. They are the foundation on which we must build, and thus will be different in every situation. But the more we know, the more we can challenge. For example, if we are considering how to improve the energy efficiency of a refrigerator, then the laws of thermodynamics can be taken as first principles. However, a theoretical chemist or physicist might want to explore entropy, and thus further break the second law into its underlying principles and the assumptions that were made because of them. First principles are the boundaries that we have to work within in any given situation. So when it comes to thermodynamics, an appliance maker might have a different first principle than a physicist. Techniques for establishing first principles. If we never learn to take something apart, test our assumptions about it, and reconstruct it, we end up bound by what other people tell us, trapped in the way things have always been done. When the environment changes, we just continue as if things were the same, making costly mistakes along the way. Some of us are naturally skeptical of what we're told. Maybe it doesn't match up to our experiences. Maybe it's something that used to be true but isn't true anymore. And maybe we just think very differently about something. When it comes down to it, everything that is not a law of nature is just a shared belief. Money is a shared belief. So is a border. So are bitcoins. So is love. The list goes on. If we want to identify the principles in a situation to cut through the dogma and the shared belief, there are two techniques we can use: Socratic questioning and the five whys. Socratic questioning can be used to establish the first principles through stringent analysis. This is a disciplined questioning process used to establish truths, reveal underlying assumptions, and separate knowledge from ignorance. The key distinction between Socratic questioning and ordinary discussions is that the former seeks to draw out first principles in a systematic manner. Socratic questioning generally follows this process. 1. Clarifying your thinking and explaining the origins of your ideas. Why do I think this? What exactly do I think? 2. Challenging assumptions. How do I know this is true? What if I thought the opposite? 3. Looking for evidence. How can I back this up? What are the sources? 4. Considering alternative perspectives. What might others think? How do I know I am correct? 5. Examining consequences and implications. What if I'm wrong? What are the consequences if I am? 6. Questioning the original questions. Why did I think that? Was it correct? What conclusions can I draw from the reasoning process? Socratic questioning stops you from relying on your gut and limits strong emotional responses. This process helps you build something that lasts. The five whys is a method rooted in the behavior of children. Children instinctively think in first principles. Just like us, they want to understand what's happening in the world. To do so, they intuitively break through the fog with a game some parents have come to dread, but which is exceptionally useful for identifying first principles, repeatedly asking why. The goal of the five whys is to land on a what or how. It is not about introspection, such as, why do I feel like this? Rather, it's about systematically delving further into a statement or concept so that you can separate reliable knowledge from assumption. If your whys result in the statement of falsifiable fact, you have hit a first principle. If they end up with a, because I said so, or it just is, you know you have landed on an assumption that may be based on popular opinion, cultural myth, or dogma. These are not first principles. There is no doubt that both of these methods slow us down in the short term. We have to pause, think, and research. They seem to get in the way of whatever we want to accomplish. And after we do them a couple of times, we realize that after one or two questions, we are often lost. We actually don't know how to answer most of the questions. But when we are confronted with our own ignorance, we can't just give up or resort to self-defense. If we do, we will never be able to identify the first principles we have to work with, and will instead make mistakes that will slow us down in the long term. Science is much more than a body of knowledge. It is a way of thinking. Carl Sagan. First principles thinking as a way to blow past inaccurate assumptions. The discovery that a bacterium, not stress, actually caused the majority of stomach ulcers is a great example of what can be accomplished when we push past assumptions to get at first principles. Since the discovery of bacteria, scientists thought the bacteria could not grow in the stomach on account of the acidity. If you had surveyed both doctors and medical research scientists in the 60s or 70s, they likely would have postulated this as a first principle. When a patient came in complaining of stomach pain, no one ever looked for a bacterial cause. It turned out, however, that a sterile stomach was not a first principle. It was an assumption. As Kevin Ashton writes in his book on creativity, discovery, and invention, the dogma of the sterile stomach said that bacteria could not live in the gut. Because this dogma was taken as truth for a long time, no one ever looked at it for reasons that could be false. That changed for the good with the discovery of H. pylori bacteria and its role in stomach ulcers. When the pathologist, Robin Warren, started seeing bacteria in samples from patients' stomachs, he realized that stomachs were not, in fact, sterile. He started collaborating with Barry Marshall, a gastroenterologist, and together they started seeing bacteria in loads of stomachs. If the sterile stomach wasn't a first principle then, when it came to stomachs, what was? Marshall, in an interview with Discover, recounts that Warren gave him a list of 20 patients identified as possibly having cancer, but when he had looked, he had found the same bacteria in all of them instead. He said, "Why don't you look at their case records and see if they've got anything wrong with them?" Since they now knew stomachs weren't sterile, they could now question all the associated dogma about stomach disease and use some Socratic-type questioning to work to identify the first principles at play. They spent years challenging their related assumptions, clarifying their thinking, and looking for evidence. Their story ultimately has a happy ending. Marshall and Warren were awarded the Nobel Prize in 2005, and now stomach ulcers are regularly treated effectively with antibiotics, improving and saving the lives of millions of people. But many practitioners and scientists rejected their findings for decades. The dogma of the sterile stomach was so entrenched as a first principle that it was hard to admit that it rested on some incorrect assumptions, which ultimately ended with the explanation, "because that's just the way it is." Even though, as Ashton notes, H. pylori has now been found in medical literature dating back to 1875, it was Warren and Marshall who were able to show that "because I said so" wasn't enough to count the sterile stomach as a first principle. Incremental innovation and paradigm shifts. To improve something, we need to understand why it is successful or not. Otherwise, we are just copying thoughts or behaviors without understanding why they worked. First principles thinking helps us avoid the problem of relying on someone else's tactics without understanding the rationale behind them. Even incremental improvement is harder to achieve if we can't identify the first principles. Temple Grandin is famous for a couple of reasons. One, she is autistic and was one of the first people to publicly disclose this fact and give insight into the inner workings of one type of the autistic mind. Second, she's a scientist who has developed many techniques to improve the welfare of animals in the livestock industry. One of the approaches she pioneered was the curved cattle chute. Previous to her experiments, cattle were put in a straight chute. Curved chutes, on the other hand, are more efficient for handling cattle because they take advantage of the natural behavior of the cattle. Cattle move through curved races more easily because they have a natural tendency to go back to where they came from. Of course, science doesn't stop with one innovation, and animal scientists continue to study the best way to treat livestock animals. For an image, go to fs.blog/tgmm. Stockmanship Journal presented research that questioned the efficiency of Grandin's curved shoot. It demonstrated that sometimes the much more simple straight shoot would achieve the same effort in terms of cattle movement. The journal sought out Grandin's response, and it is invaluable for teaching us the necessity of first principles thinking. Grandin explains that curved shoots are not a first principle. She designed them as a tactic to address the first principle of animal handling that she identified in her research, essentially that reducing stress to the animals is the single most important aspect and affects everything from conception rates to weight to immune systems. When designing a livestock environment, a straight shoot could work as long as it is part of a system that reduces stress to the animals. You can change tactics if you know the principles. Sometimes we don't want to fine-tune what is already there. We are skeptical or curious and are not interested in accepting what already exists as our starting point. So when we start with the idea that the way things are might not be the way they have to be, we put ourselves in the right frame of mind to identify first principles. The real power of first principles thinking is moving away from random change and into choices that have a real possibility of success. Starting in the 1970s, scientists began to ask, what are the first principles of meat? The answers generally include taste, texture, smell, and use in cooking. Do you know what is not a first principle of meat? Being part of an animal. Perhaps more important to consumers is the taste. Less important is whether it was actually once part of a cow. Researchers then looked at why meat tastes like meat. Part of the answer is chemical reaction between sugars and amino acids during cooking, known as the Maillard reaction. This is what gives meat its flavor and smell. By replicating this exact reaction, scientists expect to be able to replicate the first principles of meat, taste and scent. In doing so, they will largely eliminate the need to raise animals for consumption. Instead of looking for ways to improve existing constructs like mitigating the environmental impacts of the livestock industry, around 30 laboratories worldwide are now developing the means to grow artificial meat. This lab-grown meat is close to having the constituent parts of meat. One food researcher described the product this way. There's really a bite to it. There's quite some flavor with the browning. I know there is no fat in it, so I don't really know how juicy it would be, but there is some intense taste. It's close to meat. It's not that juicy, but the consistency is perfect. This is meat to me. It's really something to bite on, and I think the look is quite similar. This quote illustrates how artificial meat combines the core properties of meat to form a viable replacement, thereby addressing some significant environmental and ethical concerns. As to methods, there may be a million and then some, but principles are few. The man who grasps principles can successfully select his own methods. The man who tries methods ignoring principles is sure to have trouble. Harrington Emerson. Conclusion. Reasoning from first principles allows us to step outside of history and conventional wisdom and see what is possible. When you really understand the principles at work, you can decide if the existing methods make sense. Often, they don't. Many people mistakenly believe that creativity is something that only some of us are born with, and either we have it or we don't. Fortunately, there seems to be ample evidence that this isn't true. We're all born rather creative, but during our formative years, it can be beaten out of us by busy parents and teachers. As adults, we rely on convention and what we're told because that's easier than breaking things down into first principles and thinking for yourself. Thinking through first principles is a way of taking off the blinders. Most things suddenly seem more possible. Creativity is intelligence having fun. Anonymous. Thought experiment. Thought experiments can be defined as devices of the imagination used to investigate the nature of things. Many disciplines, such as philosophy and physics, make use of thought experiments to examine what can be known. In doing so, they can open up new avenues for inquiry and exploration. Thought experiments are powerful because they help us learn from our mistakes and avoid future ones. They let us take on the impossible, evaluate the potential consequences of our actions, and re-examine history to make better decisions. They can help us both figure out what we really want and the best way to get there. Betting on basketball. Suppose I asked you to tell me who would win in a game of basketball, the NBA champion LeBron James or the filmmaker Woody Allen. How much would you bet that your answer was correct? I think you'd get me an answer pretty quickly, and I'd hope you bet all you had. Next, suppose I asked you to tell me who'd win in a game of basketball. The NBA champion LeBron James or the NBA champion Kevin Durant? How much would you bet your answer was correct? A little harder, right? Would you bet anywhere near all you had on being right? Let's think this through. You attempted to solve both of the questions in the same way. You imagined the contest. Perhaps more importantly, you didn't attempt to solve either of them by calling up Messrs. James, Allen, and Durant and inviting them over for an afternoon of basketball. You simply simulated them in your mind. In the first case, your knowledge of James, young, tall, athletic, and skilled, Allen, old, small, frail, and funny, and the game of basketball gave you a clear mental image. The disparity between the player's abilities makes the question and the bet a total no-brainer. In the second case, your knowledge of LeBron and Durant may well be extensive, but that doesn't make it an easy bet. They're both professional basketball players who are quite similar in size and ability, and both of them are likely to go down as among the best to ever play the game. It's doubtful that one is much better than the other in a one-on-one match. The only way to answer for sure would be to see them play, and even then, a one-off contest is not going to be definitive. A better way to answer the who would win question is through a remarkable ability of the human brain, the ability to conduct a detailed thought experiment. Its chief value is that it lets us do things from our heads we cannot do in real life, and so explores situations from more angles than we can physically examine and test for. Thought experiments are more than daydreaming. They require the same rigor as a traditional experiment in order to be useful. Much like the scientific method, a thought experiment generally has the following steps. 1. Ask a question. 2. Conduct background research. 3. Construct hypotheses. 4. Test with thought experiments. 5. Analyze outcomes and draw conclusions. 6. Compare to hypotheses and adjust accordingly. In the James Allen experiment above, we started with a question. Who would win in a game of basketball? If you didn't already know who these people were, finding out would have been a necessary piece of background research. Then you came out with your hypotheses. James, all the way. And you thought it through. One of the real powers of the thought experiment is that there is no limit to the number of times you can change a variable to see if it influences the outcome. In order to place that bet, you would want to estimate, in how many possible basketball games does Woody Allen beat LeBron James? Out of a 100,000-game scenario, Allen probably only wins in the few where LeBron starts the game by having a deadly heart attack. Experimenting to discover the full spectrum of possible outcomes gives you a better appreciation for what you can influence and what you can reasonably expect to happen. Let's now explore a few areas in which thought experiments are tremendously useful. 1. Imagining physical impossibilities. 2. Reimagining history. 3. Intuiting the non-intuitive. Imagining physical impossibilities. Albert Einstein was a great user of the thought experiment because it is a way to logically carry out a test in one's own head that would be very difficult or impossible to perform in real life. With this tool, we can solve problems with intuition and logic that cannot be demonstrated physically. One of his notable thought experiments involved an elevator. Imagine you were in a closed elevator, feet glued to the floor. Absent any other information, would you be able to know whether the elevator was in outer space with a string pulling the elevator upwards at an accelerating rate or sitting on Earth being pulled down by gravity? By running the thought experiment, Einstein concluded that you would not. This led to the formulation of Einstein's second major theory, the general theory of relativity, his universal theory of gravity. Einstein's hypothesis was that the force you felt from acceleration and the force you felt from gravity didn't just feel the same, they were the same. Gravity must work similarly to the accelerating elevator. We can't build elevators in space, but we can still define some of the properties they would have if we could. This gives us enough information to test the hypothesis. Eventually, Einstein worked it all out mathematically and in great detail, but it started with a simple thought experiment, impossible to actually perform. This type of thought experiment need not only apply to physics and is actually reflected in some of our common expressions. When we say, if money were no object, or if you had all the time in the world, we are asking someone to conduct a thought experiment because actually removing that variable, money or time, is physically impossible. In reality, money is always an object, and we never have all the time in the world. But the act of detailing out the choices we would make in these alternate realities that have otherwise similar properties to our current one, doing the thought experiment is what leads to insights regarding what we value in life and where to focus our energies. Reimagining history. A familiar use of the thought experiment is to reimagine history. This one we use all the time. What if I hadn't been stuck at the airport bar where I met my future business partner? Would World War I have started if Gavrilo Princip hadn't shot the Archduke of Austria in Sarajevo? If Cleopatra hadn't found a way to meet Caesar, would she still have been able to take the throne of Egypt? These approaches are called the historical, counterfactual, and semifactual. If Y happened instead of X, what would the outcome have been? Would the outcome have been the same? As popular and generally useful as counter and semifactuals are, they are also the areas of thought experiment with which we need to use the most caution. Why? Because history is what we call a chaotic system. A small change in the beginning conditions can cause a very different outcome down the line. This is where the rigor of the scientific method is indispensable if we want to draw conclusions that are actually useful. To understand it, let's think about another chaotic system we're all familiar with, the weather. Why is it that we can predict the movement of the stars, but we can't predict the weather more than a few weeks out, and even then, it's not altogether reliable? It's because the weather is highly chaotic. Any infinitesimally small error in our calculations today will change the result down the line as rapid feedback loops occur throughout time. Since our measurement tools are not infinitely accurate and never will be, we are stuck with the unpredictability of chaotic systems. And compared to human systems, one could say weather is pretty reliable stuff. As anyone who's seen Back to the Future knows, a small change in the past could have a massive, unpredictable effect on the future. Thus, running historical counterfactuals is an easy way to accidentally mislead yourself. We simply don't know what else would have occurred had Cleopatra not met Caesar, or had you not been stuck at the airport. The potential outcomes are too chaotic. But we can use thought experiments to explore unrealized outcomes, to rerun a process as many times as we like to see what could have occurred and learn more about the limits we have to work with. The truth is, the events that have happened in history are but one realization of the historical process, one possible outcome among a large variety of possible outcomes. They're like a deck of cards that has been dealt out only one time. All the things that didn't happen but could have if some little thing went another way are invisible to us. That is, until we use our brains to generate these theoretical worlds via thought experiments. If we can also factor in the approximate probability of these occurrences relative to the scope of possible ones, we can learn what the most likely outcomes are. Sometimes it is easy to imagine 10 different ways a situation could have played out differently, but more of a stretch to change the variables and still end up with the same thing. So let's try it. First, we have to ask a question. What if Serbian Gavrilo Princip hadn't shot Austrian Archduke Franz Ferdinand? That single act has often been credited with launching World War I, so it is a question worth asking. If we conclude the assassination started a chain reaction for which war was the inevitable result, it would certainly tell us a lot about certain causal relationships in politics, diplomacy, and possibly human psychology. Then we need to do our background research. What do we need to know to be able to answer this question? So we look into it, treaties, conflicts, alliances, interests, personalities, enough to be able to formulate a hypothesis. An immediate response to the assassination was on June 30th, 1914, 2 days later. Austria changed its policy towards Serbia. Shortly after that, Germany offered full military support to Austria, and less than 2 months later, the world was at war. Thus, the next step in our thought experiment might be to refine the question. Something like, how did Princip's assassination of the Archduke influence Austrian policy towards Serbia? Our hypotheses could be one of the following. 1. The assassination had no effect on policy. 2. The assassination had a partial effect on the policy. 3. The assassination had total effect on the policy. To test any one of these, we run the experiment in our heads. We sit back and think about what the world looked like in Sarajevo on June 28, 1914. The Archduke and his wife being chauffeured in their car, Gavrilo Princip cleaning his gun somewhere. Now we imagine Princip gets stomach cramps from some bad food the night before. The Archduke's car makes it to the destination while Princip is curled up in bed. The Archduke gives a speech emphasizing peace. One of Princip's gang tries to assassinate the Archduke but fails. How does Austria react? Is it demonstrably different from what they actually did? Princip wasn't a lone wolf, and there was a lot of unrest in Serbia towards Austria. How could the situation be changed to lead to different Austrian policy? Given the climate at the time, is our hypothetical situation realistic? Meaning, can you construct a historically accurate scenario in which no events come to pass that prompt Austria's policy change? How many Serbians would have to get the stomach flu? One of the goals of a thought experiment like this is to understand the situation enough to identify the decisions and actions that had impact. This process doesn't provide definitive answers, such as whether the assassination did or did not cause World War I. What you're trying to get to is a rough idea of how much it may have contributed to starting the war. The more scenarios you can imagine where war comes to pass without the assassination, the weaker the case for it being the critical cause. Thus, by exploring the realistic relationships between events, you can better understand the most likely effects of any one decision. Intuiting the non-intuitive. One of the uses of thought experiments is to improve our ability to intuit the non-intuitive. In other words, a thought experiment allows us to verify if our natural intuition is correct by running experiments in our deliberate, conscious minds that make a point clear. An example of this is the famous veil of ignorance proposed by philosopher John Rawls in his influential theory of justice. In order to figure out the most fair and equitable way to structure society, he proposed that the designers of said society operate behind a veil of ignorance. This means that they could not know who they would be in the society they were creating. If they designed the society without knowing their economic status, their ethnic background, talents, and interests, or even their gender, they would have to put in place a structure that was as fair as possible in order to guarantee the best possible outcome for themselves. Our initial intuition of what is fair is likely to be challenged during the veil of ignorance thought experiment. When confronted with the question of how to best organize society, we have this general feeling that it should be fair. But what exactly does this mean? We can use this thought experiment to test the likely outcomes of different rules and structures to come up with an aggregate of most fair. We need not be constructing the legislation of the entire nations for this type of thinking to be useful. Think, for example, of a company's human resources policies on hiring, office etiquette, or parental leave. What kind of policies would you design or support if you didn't know what your role in the company was, or even anything about who you were? Thought experiments tell you about the limits of what you know and the limits of what you should attempt. In order to improve our decision-making and increase our chances of success, we must be willing to probe all of the possibilities we can think of. Thought experiments are not daydreams. They require both rigor and work. But the more you use them, the more you understand the actual cause and effect, and the more knowledge you have of what can really be accomplished. Sidebar: the trolley experiment. Thought experiments are often used to explore ethical and moral issues. When you're dealing with questions of life and death, it is obviously not recommended to kill a bunch of people in order to determine the most ethical course of action. This, then, is where the thought experiment is also extremely valuable. One of the most famous of this type is the trolley experiment. It goes like this. Say you are the driver of a trolley that is out of control. You apply the brakes and nothing happens. Ahead of you are five people who will die should your trolley continue on the track. At the last moment, you notice a spur that has one person on it. What do you do? Do you continue on and kill the five, or do you divert and kill the one? This experiment was first proposed in modern form by Philippa Foote in her paper, The Problem of Abortion and the Doctrine of the Double Effect, and further considered extensively by Judith Jarvis Thompson in The Trolley Problem. In both cases, the value of the thought experiment is clear. The authors were able to explore situations that would be physically impossible to reproduce without causing serious harm, and in so doing, significantly advance certain questions of morality. Moreover, the trolley problem remains relevant to this day as technological advances often ask us to define when it is acceptable and even desirable to sacrifice one to save many. And lest you think this is always the case, Thompson conducts another great thought experiment, considering a doctor killing one patient to save five through organ donation. You can see an image at fs.blog/tgmm. Sidebar: reduce the role of chance. Let's try a real-world example. Suppose you were to buy 100,000 of stock in Google with 50% paid for in cash and 50% borrowed from the brokerage firm. They call it a margin loan. A few years later, the stock price has doubled. That means one of your 100,000 is worth 200,000. Since you still owe the brokerage 50,000, your own 50,000 is now worth 150,000. You've tripled your money. You consider yourself a financial genius. Before we land on that conclusion, though, let's run our theoretical world generator a bunch of times in our head. What else could have happened but didn't? Google could have gone down 50% before it went up 100%. Nearly all stocks in the exchange have had this happen to them at some point or another. In fact, Google could have gone down 90%. The whole New York Stock Exchange did just that between 1929 and 1932. What if something like that had happened? The brokerage would have called your margin loan. Game over. Thanks for playing. You would have been worth zero. Now return to the beginning of the chapter again. If you're going to buy Google on margin, is your bet that Google won't go down 50% more, similar to the LeBron-Allen thought experiment, or the LeBron-Durant thought experiment? Running through this scenario 100,000 times, how many times do you go broke, and how many times do you triple your dough? This gives you some real decision-making power. It tells you about the limits of what you know and the limits of what you should attempt. It tells you, in an imprecise but useful way, a lot about how smart or stupid your decisions were, regardless of the actual outcome. It makes you aware of your process, so that even if the results are good, you can recognize when this was all down to luck and that maybe you should work on your decision-making process to reduce the role of chance. Supporting idea: necessity and sufficiency. We often make the mistake of assuming that having some necessary conditions in place means we have all of the sufficient conditions in place for the desired event to occur. The gap between the two is the difference between becoming a published author and becoming J.K. Rowling. Certainly, you have to know how to write very well to become either, but it isn't sufficient to become a Rowling. This is somewhat obvious to most. What's not obvious is that the gap between what is necessary to succeed and what is sufficient is often luck, chance, or some other factor beyond your direct control. Assume you wanted to make it to the Fortune 500. Capital is necessary, but not sufficient. Hard work is necessary, but not sufficient. Intelligence is necessary, but not sufficient. Billionaire success takes all of those things and more, plus a lot of luck. That's a big reason that there's no recipe. Winning a military battle is a great example of necessity and sufficiency. It is necessary to prepare for the battle by evaluating the strength and tactics of your enemy and by developing your own plan. You need to address logistics such as supplies and have a comprehensive strategy that allows flexibility to respond to the unexpected. These things, however, are not enough to win the battle. Without them, you definitely won't be successful. But on their own, they are not sufficient for success. This concept is demonstrated in sport as well. To be successful at a professional level in any sport depends on some necessary conditions. You must be physically capable of meeting the demands of that sport and have the time and means to train. Meeting these conditions, however, is not sufficient to guarantee a successful outcome. Many hardworking, talented athletes are unable to break into the professional ranks. In mathematics, they call these sets. The set of conditions necessary to become successful is a part of the set that is sufficient to become successful. But the sufficient set itself is far larger than the necessary set. Without that distinction, it's too easy for us to be misled by the wrong stories. Technology is fine, but the scientists and engineers only partially think through their problems. They solve certain aspects, but not the total, and as a consequence, it is slapping us back in the face very hard. Barbara McClintock. Second order thinking. Almost everyone can anticipate the immediate results of their actions. This type of first order thinking is easy and safe, but it's also a way to ensure that you get the same results that everyone else gets. Second order thinking is thinking further ahead and thinking holistically. It requires us to not only consider our actions and their immediate consequences, but the subsequent effects of those actions as well. Failing to consider the second and third order effects can unleash disaster. It is often easier to find examples of when second order thinking didn't happen, when people did not consider the effects of effects, when they tried to do something good or even just benign and instead brought calamity. We can safely assume the negative outcomes weren't factored into the original thinking. Very often, the second level of effects